This is Dr. James S. Spiegel in his teaching on Christian ethics. This is session number 4, The Social Contract Theory.
Okay, now we're going to talk about social contract theory. As I noted at the end of our discussion of utilitarianism, one brand of utilitarianism is rule utilitarianism, according to which we strive to abide by those rules which, if followed, will maximize pleasure for the greatest number. And social contract theory aims to follow that idea and provide certain rules that will guide us as individuals as well as a whole society, and to ground our concepts of moral obligation as well as political rights in these fundamental rules which are chosen to guide society. And the idea is that if we as a society can come to some sort of agreement on what the basic rules will be to guide society, then that will make for the most peaceful, harmonious, productive, happy, and satisfied society. And it's called a social contract theory because the idea is that you forge some sort of agreement, a formal agreement among the citizens in the society in order to achieve this. So this will avoid some of the problems that plague act utilitarianism, like the problem of application, the problem of rights, the problem of justice, at least if the social contract theory succeeds in other regards. Some of the major proponents of social contract theory include Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and John Rawls. We'll talk about three of these philosophers, beginning with Thomas Hobbes, who he said that fear and I were born twins because his mother was pregnant with him during the sinking of the Spanish Armada, and that was in 1588. She didn't know if, well, this is going to be the end, we're all going to die here, when she heard about this, and she went into labor and gave birth to Thomas Hobbes. But he did just fine. The guy lived about 90 years. So, but he wrote this book, Leviathan, and this is the frontispiece from that book, which, if we were able to zoom in on that character there holding the sword and the trident or whatever that is, that he's made up of hundreds or thousands of individuals, which is it's a good image for the idea of a social contract, where you get people agreeing, coming together and agreeing on certain basic principles to guide society so that they can operate, as it were, like a single individual. So, but Hobbes's his brand of social contract theory is unique among the early modern social contract theorists because he defends a kind of absolute political sovereignty. The other social contract theorists emphasize consent of the governed and even a right to revolt. That isn't Hobbes's approach. He doesn't believe in a right of revolution. But we'll talk about the other ones later. First, with regard to Hobbes, he begins with this concept of a state of nature where human beings are not governed by any laws, where people just get what they want from nature, the food, the shelter that they need, the clothes that they need, and there is no governing authority. What would life be like in that circumstance? Whether or not there ever was a true state of nature in human history, what would that be like if there were no governing authorities? According to Hobbes, it would be a condition of war. Why? Because you and I, at some point, are going to want the same thing. And with limited resources, because we don't have an infinite amount of goods out there that we can acquire, we're going to come into competition at some point. And since I want it really bad, and you want it really bad, at some point, it comes down to, I'll fight you for it, right? And this creates a condition of war. And it's not just you and me. You got hundreds or thousands of other people in the state of nature. It's going to be chaos. It's going to be a bloody mess. And so in such a state of nature, Hobbes famously says, life is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Okay? But who wants that? Who wants to live in a condition of war, enmity, where we're all living in fear? We need to get what we want out of nature, but I don't want to have to be fighting people for this. The fact that human beings are roughly equal in terms of our intelligence and our physical strength, that compounds the problem here, because each of us thinks, I think I could beat him. I can come up with a way to defeat him. And if we're equally confident that we could prevail in that competition, then that just adds to the possibility or likelihood of conflict. So just to kind of represent it here, we have a kind of equality of hope or ability in attaining things, combined with our desire for the same things, that's what leads to a certain enmity and condition of war in a state of nature. So the question is, how can we overcome this problem? How can we avoid this condition of war and likely fighting and the fear that comes with this? We don't want to always be living in fear. So this is where Hobbes proposes that there are certain basic rights and laws that apply to us just because we are rational beings. The most fundamental right of nature, he says, is the liberty of self-preservation. I have the right to preserve my own life. And I have the right to use whatever power I may to preserve my life. That's a basic right of nature, a basic right to life, he's acknowledging there. And then he also maintains that there's a fundamental law of nature which corresponds to that right to life, liberty of self-preservation, and that is a duty to preserve life, a basic prohibition of destruction. Now, he doesn't, I don't think, adequately ground this law of nature and this right of nature. He would say it's based ultimately in our capacity as rational beings, but I'd like to know something more, you know, what really grounds this basic right and this law? Where does it come from? just to appeal to our universal desire for these things and our rational capacities is not enough, but be that as it may, this is his claim, and that we should strive to respect this right of nature and abide by this law of nature to preserve life. So his prescription is for all of the people together to transfer their particular rights to some sovereign individual, or maybe a small number of people, but usually it's represented as a monarch, a king, a queen. To exchange our rights to this political sovereign in exchange for the promise of protection and the preservation of my freedom. So I give up something and I gain something, right? We're making a deal here. It's a contract, it's a compact, it's an agreement we're going to enter into. And we're going to have to choose someone who's very trustworthy. Someone who's reliable and they have the kind of character that you could, you know, trust that they won't abuse this sovereign power. But what we will do is we'll surrender, you know, a number of our particular rights in exchange for the promise that we'll be protected. And even though we lose our absolute freedom, we gain protection and we no longer have to live in fear. Because as a sovereign makes laws that are punishable if you violate those laws, particularly with severe infractions, and you know that you may go to prison or be executed if you murder or rape, then that fear that originally characterized, you know, most of life in the state of nature now only applies to those who violate these laws. You don't have to fear anything if you just abide by the laws. So the sovereign will make these laws, and there's consequences, some of them deadly if you violate the most important laws, in order to create a stable, harmonious society, and also to take away the fear that would otherwise prevent us from experiencing true happiness. And the way that this transfer, this exchange is made, is through the social contract or covenant. And in our society, again, we have one such contract, and it's called our Constitution, but we have all sorts of other laws. And we have traded in a certain freedom for security, right? I can't just drive down the road at 150 miles an hour if my car could go that fast. Probably go 100, 120. But I'm forbidden. I've given up my freedom to do that, you know, knowing that the consequences will be such that I'll be arrested or I'll get a severe fine, maybe get my license taken away, and then my freedoms are proscribed even more. So I say, okay, I agree not to drive past a certain limit, you know, which varies from road to road, in exchange for this security I have, because I can count on other people also abiding by the speed limits, right? And that protects me. So it's a deal we make. It's a kind of contract we make with those who rule us and our peers in society. But in Hobbes's proposal, there's one sovereign who's in control of all of it, which the crown in his day was very pleased to see that he was reinforcing their political authority. So that is something that creates a little bit of suspicion of Hobbes's real motives for many scholars. But there were other social contract theorists who were not so much interested in just defending status quo in terms of divine right of kings and queens. And one of those was John Locke, who lived a little bit later. he too, a British thinker. In 1690, he published his two treatises on civil government, his second treatise on civil government being the most influential, one of the most influential political documents ever written. Our Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Declaration of Independence, essentially summarizes and applies Locke's political theory. A good way to know what Locke thought is just to read our Declaration of Independence. Our founding fathers were very astute in terms of following what was going on in terms of social contract theory in that day, and also looking back at ancient Greek and Roman thought. And with this new world they had discovered, that they were living in, that it had been discovered by Europeans a century or two earlier, they thought, hey, this is our chance now that we've driven out the savages, as they called them, to start from scratch. We've got basically a state of nature. Of course, the Native Americans would have, they would have said things a bit differently. But be that as may, for all that injustice, the Americans at the time from Europe decided we're going to start a new nation. Who are we going to look to in order to guide us in terms of, you know, creating this new system? And they decided to go with the social contract theory, and it was basically Locke's version of that. Locke, like Hobbes, began with this notion of a state of nature, also with this idea of a condition of war, and with natural rights and laws. He thought that Hobbes was basically on the right track here. The natural rights that Locke identifies are life, liberty, and property. In our Declaration of Independence, Jefferson changed that just a little bit, the property to the pursuit of happiness, make it a bit more expansive. but Locke did believe in these natural rights and also a basic law of nature as well, the duty not to harm other people. But we need, again, sharing Hobbes's intuition, some sort of contract to preserve that freedom, to curb human nature, to secure property rights. So all of that, very much like Thomas Hobbes, but where Locke departs is in his rejection of Hobbes's notion of an absolute political sovereign. He doesn't believe that that's appropriate, absolute sovereignty. He advocates for this idea of consent of the governed. And thankfully, I would say thankfully, the founding fathers thought this was the best way to go. And let's go with Locke's idea of consent of the governed, where the people rule themselves by way of appointed deputies or political representatives. So we elect people to serve us at all these different levels, local, state, federal levels, to serve in these various capacities as lawmakers, as those who also enforce the law with the executive function, and judges who judge on the law. Even have a kind of tripartite government system with balance of powers that Locke envisioned, as did other social contract theorists like Montesquieu. But the idea of consent of the governed was rather novel at this time, that you're making the people, as it were, indirectly sovereign. So you rule over me, civil magistrate, you know, legislator, executor, president, prime minister. You rule over me only because I and my peers have stipulated that. We've put you into power. We will vote you in, we can vote you out. So it is a kind of rule by consent of the governed. And even though it's the original founding fathers who drafted this social contract for us, and many generations have gone by since, we're all bound by it. Locke used the term or the phrase tacit consent to apply here, where even if an individual has not signed the social contract, and nobody alive today has signed the U.S. Constitution, only a few dozen people signed it originally, but that was meant to represent all of the people, and to this day it represents all of Americans. Locke says by tacit consent that the fact that I've stayed in this country and I've benefited from all of its laws and all of the provisions that government gives us, I've accepted all that. I have flourished because of the system. That shows that I have shown my consent. That is a demonstration of my consent to abide by the stipulations within our social contract and all the particular laws that these rulers have made by the consent of those they govern. So that is a critical element in Locke's theory. The other one is this right of revolt, or right of revolution. Because the rulers only govern by consent, and there is a standing agreement that this is the duty of the governors, of the rulers, to enforce these laws and to serve the people in just ways. If they significantly depart from that, if they violate their own part of the deal and don't follow through on their commitment to properly govern, to make laws, to judge laws, and to enforce them, then they have essentially surrendered their right to govern us. And that means that we can rebel against a highly oppressive regime, because what this oppressive regime has done by violating our rights in this way and departing from the contract is they've thrown us back into a state of nature. And in that condition, then, we have the right to rebel, to revolt, to start a revolution. And this was highly influential on our founding fathers. And their rationale, all those years later, later in the 18th century, when they judged that, you know, the British crown had been abusive, so abusive through taxation without representation and, you know, quartering soldiers in people's houses, you know, not respecting property, that it was time to revolt. And so a revolutionary war happened. Our founding fathers thought this is a simple, straightforward application of the Lockean right of revolution. So that's an important distinctive of Locke's political theory that's affected all of our lives, right? If you're a U.S. citizen, you have Locke to thank or curse for that. Now, it's an open question, and we'll talk about this when we talk about war, whether a revolutionary war is ever just. You know, what are the standards for a just war? For those who believe in just war, there are pacifists who don't. But if you believe that wars are sometimes just, when, if ever, is a revolutionary war appropriate? There are many who would say never, and then they would have to conclude that the American Revolutionary War was an unjust war. and we'll talk about that. The third and final social contract theorist is a more recent scholar named John Rawls, who taught at Harvard for many years, and he wrote this landmark work in social contract theory called A Theory of Justice. And it's not controversial to say that Rawls is the most important social contract theorist of the 20th century. Now, he takes a bit of a different route to the fundamental rules or principles that he believes we should be governed by in a social contract situation. He does believe that we should choose those principles that are most just. The question is, how do we get there? And this is where he proposes a rather novel thought experiment for arriving at basic principles of justice. He doesn't appeal to the notion of a state of nature like Hobbes and Locke do. That's a useful fiction anyway. It's not a real thing. It's a kind of thought experiment, right? Nobody knows what the original state of nature was, so, you know, even Hobbes and Locke would have to admit that's just a kind of thought experiment. John Rawls argues that, or he proposes, that another thought experiment will be more useful, and that is what he calls a veil of ignorance. The question is, what principles would you select as the foundational guiding principles in society if you were in a condition where you were unaware, say, temporarily unaware, the kind of sort of temporary amnesia regarding the particulars of your life, what race you are, what gender you are, what age you are, whether you're abled or disabled, what your IQ is, what your particular talents are. Suppose you forgot all those things about yourself. What principles would you choose to be the ones that guided your society, knowing once you remember or your memory of your particular characteristics is restored, you could be handicapped, you could be a minority, or you could be white, you could be talented or not in a certain way. What are the principles you would choose? That's how we should go about this, according to Rawls. He believes this veil of ignorance thought experiment will lead us to the most reliable and useful principles of justice. And so he settles on two different principles, which are then applied very thoroughly by him to various institutions as he develops the nuts and bolts of his theory. And one of them is the principle of equal liberty. According to the principle of equal liberty, each person is to have an equal right to the most extensive basic liberty that's compatible with a similar liberty for others. So let's maximize liberty as much as possible to the extent that that's compatible with everybody else's liberty. It's kind of an application or articulation of the idea that my right to swing my arm stops at the end of your nose. Okay. Generally speaking, we should maximize liberty for individuals to the extent that that's consistent with the liberty of other individuals. And then this principle is offset by or accompanied by something he calls the difference principle. And according to this principle, which recognizes that there will always be inequalities, inequality to some degree is always unavoidable in a society where you have, you know, lots and lots of people. So to what extent should these be permitted? According to the difference principle, the social and economic inequalities are to be arranged so that they are, one, reasonably expected to be to everyone's advantage, and secondly, attached to positions and offices that are open to all. Now, this principle is far more controversial than the principle of equal liberty in terms of, you know, scholarly attention and discussion and debate. But the basic idea, yeah, is that to the extent that there are inequalities permitted, social and economic inequalities, they need to be such that everybody can seem to be helped or benefited by them. And so, well, what does that mean? How could someone, you know, who's in a lower position socioeconomically benefit from someone being in a higher position? Well, if the person that's in that higher position is doing things that are socially valuable that benefit people on the other rungs, right? So a physician, say, a neurosurgeon like a Ben Carson, here's a guy who's extremely wealthy. How did he get wealthy? He's way up the socioeconomic ladder. Oh, doing brain surgery and saving lives, doing something, executing a procedure and applying skills that the rest of us don't have, right? And he was able to do that through years and years and years of intense training. He was willing to do that. He had the cognitive ability as well as the steady hand and patience to do that. And so I'm certainly happy to be in a society where people benefit greatly and even become millionaires as neurosurgeons and doing all sorts of other excellent work in medicine, because it benefits me, right? And so it goes even with, depending on who you are, you might say, yeah, athletes and entertainers, they can be paid millions too, because I really appreciate the music and the film and watching football games played at a high level and so on. But these are the sorts of things that, in a context of Rawlsian social contract theory, we may debate, you know. What sorts of services or skills that people have that they earn lots of money for, is it appropriate for them to earn that much more money? Is it really appropriate for an NBA player or some other professional athlete to make millions of dollars a year putting a rubber ball through a metal ring or hitting cowhide with ash wood? Really? So many would say, Ben Carson, sure. Right, a neurosurgeon, yeah. But I'm not so convinced that, you know, Clayton Kershaw, you know, throwing a ball 95 miles an hour over and over again, that should garner him hundreds of millions of dollars. So there's a lot of particulars we can debate here, but this is a basic idea. And the second part of the difference principle is that those socioeconomic inequalities, you know, on the upper end, where people are millionaires and billionaires, those opportunities need to be at least available to all, right? It needs to at least in principle be possible that anybody could get there. Now, is that even achievable? That, again, is open to question, but that's the basic idea. So Rawls develops this theory extensively, and it's another version of contract theory. You know, it's the same basic idea with Hobbes and Locke, that there would be some sort of formal agreement that would constitute that contract, and then society would be constructed accordingly. Now, that's a pretty good taste of major social contract theories, and I think there are certain strengths we need to acknowledge here. Social contract ethics does give us some simple and plausible answers to some difficult questions regarding how we should live, at least in a polis, in a civil society. It provides moral rules even for skeptics and relativists. It encompasses everyone. I mean, if you're living in that society with that particular social contract, all these rules apply to you. So it involves everyone, and that seems to be a strength of this theory. And it also it capitalizes on a very important insight, which is captured in something called the prisoner's dilemma, which is a favorite kind of thought experiment in game theory, which shows that in certain situations, people acting in their own self-interest will make choices that actually are not optimum and that work out against their own self-interest, and that the most rational thing is actually to be willing to make some sacrifices for the sake of the good of the whole, and then that will benefit me, making these sacrifices and being not entirely self-absorbed, that will be for the best for me and for everyone else. We need to be willing to sacrifice some of our interests to achieve our best interests. That's kind of the the paradox captured in the prisoner's dilemma, and that is, you know, affirmed in social contract ethics. So those are significant strengths, insights of social contract theory. Here are some problems, though. one problem is that social contract theory is based on some thought experiments that are not entirely reliable, right? You got historical fictions like the state of nature, and thought experiment like the veil of ignorance. How trustworthy is that? And maybe my intuitions about what we would settle upon as basic principles or rules to govern society are not the same ones that you would choose. And it makes rights and duties artificial, right? This is a kind of contrived way of arriving at moral rules. And are they really moral rules so much as political mandates that don't really get to the foundational level of morality? And he would make that criticism, which I think is important as well. And thirdly, universal agreement on certain principles does not guarantee that those principles themselves are just. So, take Rawls, for example. He settles on equal liberty and the difference principle, which he believes that people behind a veil of ignorance would choose as the ultimate guidelines for society. One, how can he be so sure that's what everybody would choose? Wouldn't there likely be some people who would disagree with that? Maybe it would be the majority. Maybe it's just Rawls and a minority of the best thinkers who would settle on those principles. We kind of are at his mercy when we're reading his book, right? That these are the principles that rational people would choose behind a veil of ignorance. But even more fundamental than that is, even if these are the principles that rational people would choose, it doesn't follow that those principles themselves are just. Just because these are the principles that people would tend to agree upon, it doesn't follow that the principles themselves are most just. So there's a leap there. It's a kind of non sequitur that I think is a fatal flaw in Rawls's theory, assuming that the likelihood of people choosing certain principles guarantees that the principles themselves are just. So social contract ethics is a way of working out the rural utilitarian view, extremely important historically. And again, all of our lives have been deeply affected by this. And ingenious in many ways and very practical. And from a political standpoint, you know, this might very well be the best we can do. But there are still flaws, and most importantly, is this really sufficient for morality, capturing our deepest moral duties and obligations and rights? There is a pretty significant limitation in social contract theory. Many would argue, I would argue, as useful as this theory is from a political standpoint in crafting a society, you know, with the Constitution, it isn't really of much help in terms of telling us what our most deep moral duties, universal moral duties and rights are. And so we'll have to move on to some other theory that would be more adequate. And that's what we'll do next.
This is Dr. James S. Spiegel in his teaching on Christian ethics. This is session number 4, The Social Contract Theory.